The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jessica.
Hi, good evening. My name is Jessica, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. So before I came to the meeting, I was thinking about how terrified I was. Naturally, and that was quickly cut short with another thought that was even more terrifying for me, which was, what would I be doing if I wasn't speaking here tonight? What would I be doing if I didn't have this fellowship, if I didn't have my sponsor, if I didn't have this program and the testimony of hundreds and thousands of alcoholics who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of body and mind to follow suit after? That scares me so much. So I guess it's safe to say that I'm overflowing with gratitude, but it didn't always look like that for me. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous a little over a year ago, and I'm thinking, I'm 27, like, life is over as we know it. I am going to be sitting at home, like, knitting sweaters, eating bonbons for the rest of my life. I was heartbroken, and, you know, the things that I saw in these rooms, like, equally confused and terrified me. You know, I saw a woman who was like 8 months pregnant, and I'm thinking, like, why does she need to keep coming to AA? Like, doesn't she have this bump that's keeping her from a drink? You know, I met my sponsor, and she's telling me she had 20 years, and I'm like, oh my gosh, 20 years and you still come to all of these meetings and you're involved and you have commitments and you sponsor, you know, more women. I just, my heart sank because I felt like this was, you know, a death sentence for me. Like, I didn't understand why you would want to be in AA. If you Googled, or if you looked at my Google search history for the first month, you would have found things like, you know, help, I think I'm joining a cult, or like, I'm getting brainwashed. Like, I really was extremely cynical and pessimistic, even though, like, I showed a smile and I was nice to all of you, but I really just didn't believe any of you. So if you're new and you're really angry and you're mad that you're here and you don't want to be here and I'm boring you, welcome. I felt the same exact way. So what brought me in here? I will cut to the chase. I was kicked out of my best friend's wedding party and wedding altogether for getting a little too turned up at her bachelorette party in Key West. So I was a whirling tornado of debauchery, profanity, drunkenness, nudity. Like, I honestly don't even remember because I wasn't really present. But it's kind of fitting that that's how I bottomed out, because that's who I was when I was drinking. You know, I was a party girl. I was a sorority girl. I was at the club till sunrise. If you didn't find me at happy hour, I was like on my way to Coachella. Like, that's who I was. And, you know, for as much as I was a dedicated party queen, there was like this duality. You know, I was extremely driven, hardworking, ambitious, you know, from day one in grade school, straight A's, full ride to college. You know, so it's like I was Hermione from Harry Potter and like Snooki from the Jersey Shore. And like, that's who I was. It was really like the dual life, and I had to keep everything separate. The people had to be separate, like very buttoned up and professional at work, and you know, like, woo-woo over the weekend. You know, on Friday at 6 p.m. till Sunday at like midnight or the wee hours of the morning, I was in a blackout. And I had feelings like, from time to time, that, you know, what I now know is unmanageability. I would think like, oh my gosh, like, how can I keep up this charade? Like, it was just hard to manage my own life. And sometimes I would dance with the idea of stopping, but that would be stopped short with the unfathomable. But how? Like, how can I possibly stop drinking? Like, my whole persona was, like, I was the Chardonnay queen. That was who I was. And I just couldn't, like, picture my life without it. So, you know, I'm so grateful now in hindsight that what happened in Key West did, because without me literally being surrounded and having to put my hands up, like, I was caught. I was found out. My whole circle of girlfriends were like, Jessica has gone mad. Like, she needs help. We're kicking her out of this wedding. Like, it was social suicide. So I felt like this is the only way that I can at least prove to them that I'm going to get better, that, like, I'll fix myself, whatever, AA. And also, mind you, that was like a month and a half after the bachelorette party. I still continued drinking until finally coming in. So I met my sponsor on my fourth day at the Thursday beginners meeting. And I went out to fellowship after. And I was just, you know, you all like ran up to me after the meeting. When I announced my day count of 4 days, there was like uproarious applause. And, you know, I've never felt so much compassion. It was sincere, you know, it was people who truly cared. Like, no one called me. The bartender was never like, hey, Jess, where are you? But if I don't come to a meeting, you know, it's like people ask where I am. They're curious. They care about me. Thank you. So I get my sponsor. I figure I'm going to do this thing. And we met for, you know, every Sunday we met at the bagel place by the Sunday night meeting. And we would sit for hours. We started this step work right away. And, you know, compared to my psychologist who would, you know, tell me things not from her own experience, it was always kind of like, well, what do you know? And I always felt like my sponsor, you know, she's speaking from experience. She gets me. Our stories are not exactly the same. There's an underlying thread, and it was so much easier to hear what she had to say than anybody else. The hardest part of sponsorship for me was really just telling her when things weren't perfect. I was someone who my whole life, no matter what I was going through, everything is fine. You know, like, I just wanted you to think that I was the prettiest, smartest, most perfect person you've ever met, that my life was all together, that I had no flaws. You know, and it was exhausting. So, you know, my sponsor, for the longest time, and still today, I have trouble maybe revealing when things aren't necessarily going, you know, as planned, or if I'm having a hard time with something or someone. You know, when I make an amends to someone and let's say it didn't go my way, I'm like, oh no, I don't have a resentment, I'm fine. And then it's like, she'll tell me in the most loving way possible, you know, hey, just keep a lookout for it. Like, watch, this might creep up. And it's not in an obtrusive way or like, I know better, but she's looking out for me. And, you know, it's something that it's a continuous learning process. And for something that, you know, I just thought that my problem was I couldn't stop drinking. I slowly learned through meeting with her and coming to meetings that I suffer from, you know, this threefold illness. It's a spiritual malady. I have this hole in me. You know, I have a mental obsession where all I can think about is when my next drink is coming from, in addition to the physical allergy of not being able to stop. But for a spiritual malady, there needs to be a spiritual solution. I needed to find God, and I always thought that I believed in Him. I think I did, but I never really had faith, and that as well is a continuous and ongoing practice. So did my life get better a year into this? Absolutely. You know, I realize I'm not perfect, which, you know, should have been the biggest downfall of my existence, but it's like this big sigh of relief now. It's like I can finally breathe. I don't need to put up this charade anymore. You know, being able to take accountability for my actions and things that I've done wrong in my life is seriously the biggest blessing. And that's not the same person that I was when I walked in here. I've since then flown all the way to Chicago to make amends to my best friend who kicked me out of her wedding. And this is not something that I would ever have been able to do in the past. And to look literally the demise of my existence in the eye and not say, but you did this, and well, you know, I was uncomfortable at your bachelorette party and blah, 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 making up all these excuses and trying to manipulate and twist and control. Instead, I just took accountability. And for some, that might be simple, but for me, that's not in my character. So there's been a tremendous amount of growth. I can't believe I have 1 minute left. but I will say, if you are here, there's a reason why you're sitting here. Please stay and let us help you. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Roland.
Hello, my name is Roland, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, Atlantic Group. Hi. There's a lot of people. My life changed in this room. Changed. 10 minutes. How? How am I going to do this? I took my first drink on the train tracks with the guys. Didn't change my life right away, but it definitely worked. Definitely worked. When life started to become baffling, as it always does for an alcoholic, as we begin to grow up and other people begin to have jobs that they can actually stay at, and other people, you know, their families aren't angry with them all the time. They actually call them, right? You know, people who aren't being thrown out of places and, you know, their lives are moving forward. Or their lives are, your life is moving forward, our life is moving forward, but we're completely miserable. Completely, everything going for us, but we're completely miserable. Well, once that started to happen, alcohol did this for me. I'd drink, I'd be maybe at my second, maybe my third, and all of a sudden this would happen. And all of it would disappear. And my whole entire perspective would change. The bartender that was annoying me would be my best friend. And, you know, I'd be like, I can do it. I can do it. And I'd talk about all the amazing things that I was going to do with my life. Incredible things. I would dream of incredible pomp and power. Right? And nothing happened. I just lost another job. Or I lost another relationship. Or I hurt another person. Or I didn't show up and then lost another opportunity. You know, and this just kept happening. And then, you know, I would draw a line and I would say, I'm not going over that line. That's it. I'm not me. Please. Like with fervor, right? I just kept crossing them, kept crossing them. Before I knew it, I was drinking with the people I said I would never drink with. And I was sleeping with the people I said I would never sleep with. And I smelled like the people I said I would never smell like. And I was losing the things in my life that were most important to me. And I was losing myself. And this just went on and on and on. And I kept making resolutions, firm resolutions, that I wasn't going to do this to myself anymore. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to stop. And then I came up with formulas. I'm only going to drink wine. I'm only going to drink vodka. I'm only going to drink artisanal beers. And I'll just mention this once, but I thought this was a really great solution. I'm only going to do crystal meth. I thought that was brilliant. Only an alcoholic like me would think that staying awake for 5 days at a time was a good idea. I had all these solutions about what was going to work for me until I was dying and my teeth were wrecked. And I had lost weight and I had lost another job. My rent was 8 months in arrears. And I went to, I don't know what, just one day it happened. I went to Gay Men's Health Crisis and I said, I'm an addict. And someone helped me there. Someone who was sober helped me. I went to a harm reduction group. In that harm reduction group, I was introduced to meetings. I met some people. Right around that time, I met Ava. And there was a man that Ava was helping. And he would tell me every day. He would talk about Ava all the time. And the things that she would say to him, the things that he would try, that she would recommend to him that were changing his life. And he would say, "Roland, Ava says try this." And I'd give it a try. That man spent the last healthy 6 months of his life taking my phone calls. He later died of cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. His Charlie and his sacrifice, thank you, taught me about what I'm supposed to do, the time that I need to sacrifice for another alcoholic. The lengths I'm supposed to go through. I'm supposed to take my little wants and needs and put them aside. And I've done that. I've practiced that. So anyway, I started to come up with my own idea. And I thought, I'm not happy. So I stopped listening and I went and I started getting guys' numbers and going to the gym and getting dates and, you know, I got some new swag and I was like, you know, I was like, the problem is I'm not happy. That's the problem. Not alcoholism. I'm not happy. And there's nothing wrong with new swag. There's nothing wrong with getting guys' numbers or girls for some of you. There's nothing wrong with going to the gym or yoga or whatever. It's just for me, that was not a treatment for my alcoholism. I needed this. And so, of course, I drank. And it was March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. Not because it was St. Patrick's Day. I just drank because I had nothing between me and the first drink, right? So I drank a bottle of Heineken or a bottle of Stoli and 12 Heinekens in like 3 hours and wandered around, you know, looking for whatever I thought I was looking for. Happiness. Happiness. I'm not happy. But 3 days later, what I found after that relapse was I found a guy named George. George had been coming to this group for about a year and a half, and he was a completely different person. And I'd met him in another fellowship a year before that. And I saw him just on the street one day, and he said, "Roland, what's up?" And I just started to cry. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I just drank. I'm right back to where I started. I don't know what to do. He brought me to a meeting of Atlantic Group. We sat down. And people started talking. People were cracking the big book in circles, and they were talking about alcoholism. I came to the Thursday night meeting. Jeff said, "Hey," I had 8 days. And Jeff said, "Hey, you have a sponsor?" I said, "No." He said, "Dave, come over here." Dave came over. Dave was my sponsor, Dave P. He was a Wall Street guy, straight. We had nothing in common. Nothing in common. Dave took me through the steps. We met every week. Moonstruck Diner, right over here. We met every week. Went through the steps. And then I started sponsoring other people. Took them through the steps. And God did for them what they couldn't do for themselves, just like he did for me. And so I want to talk about alcoholism a little bit. Jessica already mentioned three things, right? Spiritual, mental, physical. Physical, I cannot put it in my body without stopping. I can't regulate it. I can't say I'm just going to have a couple. It completely takes over. Mental. When I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. But not only that, I'm also going to be convinced at some point, even though all of this wreckage has happened, thank you, I'm going to be convinced somehow that it's okay, it's going to be different the next time. That's the problem, right? And then spiritual. Well, I'll finish with this. And the spiritual experience in the Appendix 2 describes the spiritual experience very plainly. And I need things to be pragmatic. It says, it explains it as a profound alteration in our reaction to life. Doesn't mean we're not going to get angry. Doesn't mean we're not going to get jealous. Doesn't mean we're not going to make mistakes. It means that when we do those things, instead of reacting and doing the things that we did before, we're going to try something new. If you're in this room, I guarantee it's probably time for you to try something new. Keep coming.
And our main speaker tonight is Elise.
Hi, my name is Elsie, and I am an alcoholic. And I really just want to take a moment of silence to thank God for saving me and separating me from alcohol. I want to thank Randy for asking me to speak tonight. This is amazing. Thanks, the two 10-minute speakers. Jessica and Roland were awesome, and I really needed to hear what they had to say. I wanted to just tell you all that I'm closer. All right. Let me just get this super close. All right. Anyway, there you go. So, I wanted to just say I am super nervous, and, you know, I would say that, you know, I used to get less nervous speaking than I actually get now. And, you know, I feel like it's like, for me, it's like God's shaking me, you know, that this is an important position to sit and to be able to speak in front of people, to actually have the opportunity to give somebody that one more speaker, that one more meeting, that one more moment where, you know, that might be their moment of grace. So I take it really seriously. I guess that's what's happened. So I'm going to start out by saying that I grew up in Long Island. My parents, they were living in Hell's Kitchen in Chelsea, and then they decided to move us out to Long Island for a better life. So I moved out to Long Island. I often don't share this, but I feel recently compelled to say that early on in my life, when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I had some really serious traumatizing stuff go on in my childhood. And, you know, at that moment, I kind of separated from the planet. You know, I kind of started to feel like I didn't fit in. I remember stealing food. I remember stealing my mom's cigarettes. I remember wanting to run away from home. And, you know, that feeling kind of went with me through the next few years of my life. I found pretty early on I started to want to hang out with older kids, want to get, you know, into drinking, into getting out of myself. You know, and I'd like to say, like, for a long time in sobriety, even people told me that, you know, that's why I was an alcoholic. You know, that's why. And, you know, today, thank God, you know, the doctor's opinion really cleared that up for me. Because it's not my opinion, it's the doctor's opinion. Like, I have a broken brain, you know? My brain isn't working. Plenty of people get traumatized like I did. They did not chase alcohol into the gates of hell. They didn't blow up their entire life. I did. Just lower this. All right. I feel like it's really high. All right. I actually took notes tonight, which is something I never really do, but I wanted to really remember some of the stuff that really went on. My first drink was, you know, was exactly what Roland had said. My first drink was the solution. When I drank my first drink, I actually felt that ease and comfort. I finally arrived. It was what I had been looking for through all different things. I was looking for that comfort and that ease, and my first drink gave it to me. So I continued to chase that. I continued to, you know, get in trouble at school, get kicked out of school, get kicked out of my house, all those wonderful things that come along with drinking. I found drugs, and it was a marriage made in heaven, alcohol and drugs. I was a bartender. It was a perfect fit. I really hate talking about my story. I really hate talking about drinking. I really do. I mean, I think about it, and I think about it was so long. My sober date's June 6, 1993. It was a lifetime ago that I drank. I can remember these thoughts, and I remember what happened. But for me, you know, it's really living in the solution. You know, I'm the problem. Alcohol wasn't my problem. I'm my problem. And no matter how many 24s I have, I still fall back into selfishness, self-seeking, and all of those things that drove me to pick up a drink. So I'm just going to really bring you to, like, the last, you know, last few months of my debacle. My mom and my dad were really, you know, I only realized this fact recently. Like, you can still have spiritual awakenings. I always thought my parents were really dysfunctional, and, like, you know, my mom was a ripping alcoholic, my dad was whatever. My dad was severely sick. They both were really sick in their own thing, but I realized that as I continued to drink and do drugs, my parents got sicker. And they got sicker, and my family got sicker. You know, I always thought it was them, but now that I have this insight, I look back and I see the damage that I did in my addiction. You know, my parents withstood 10 years of my addiction while I lived in their house. I, like, was a tornado ripping through their hearts. You know, and this conversation I had one morning was, send me money or I'm going to do something really bad. And my mom said, you're never going to talk to me again. And all I could think of is, that's great. I hope I never see you again. So I came home from my run, and my mom was actually laying on the ground, and she had taken a possibly lethal dose of heart medication and stopped her heart. So when I came in the house, I looked at her on the ground, and I felt really resentful. I felt like she was interfering with my run, and I was really pissed off. And I called 911, and the police were going to come to my house, and that's always a party killer, you know. A bunch of cops busting the door down. So they tried to tell me to go to the hospital, and I thought, wow, I'm going to lose my bar job. Imagine that, you know, because I have to go to the hospital. And that's who I am. That's really who I am, left to my disease. You know, thank God they did some medical magic, and they brought my mom back to life. And my mom stayed in a psych center for 30 days. And for those 30 days, I'd like to say that God creeped into my house and I had a spiritual awakening. I realized that, like, I'm the cinder block in the puddle. I'm the one that's trashing through everybody's life. That it's not all these other things. Like, it's me. I'm the common denominator in all the wreckage that I'm involved with. So I was able at that time to call up a friend and go to my first meeting. It was a young and powerless meeting. It was a young people's meeting. It was awesome. There was kids barefoot. They were crying and laughing in the same share. They were playing Suicidal Tendencies and playing Frisbee. You know, I was like at home. You know, I felt like, wow, these people are just like me. And you know what I really felt there? Is I felt loved. And I felt like I could say out loud that I was, you know, I was drinking and smoking crack, and they didn't even blink. They didn't even blink. Where else could you say that in a group of people? And they immediately accept you. They're like, yo, you're my friend. I don't even know you. You know? It was great. They invited me to the diner, and I went to the diner, and I got a sponsor, and she said I had to be willing to do anything. And I was like, sure, except for this, except for not stop smoking pot, not stop seeing my boyfriend, not work in a bar, not this, not, I had a whole bunch of lists of things I really wasn't willing to do, but I said yes. You know, I wanted to be an AA like Jess. I was like, yeah, I'll just go with these people. You know, and I, I actually stayed for about 9 months. And I picked and I chose at all the suggestions. And I thought I was too cool for school. You know, I wasn't like you all. I was different. And I went back out. And when I went back out with a head full of AA. And lots of things happened on my relapse. You know, the most apparent thing that happened on my relapse, and this is so crazy, I could say my story over and over, and I get a new enlightening experience about my own story. On my relapse, I was in Brooklyn at like 4 o'clock in the morning one night, and my ex-boyfriend was asking me for a ride home. And I was like, yeah, no. You can't come in my car because you don't really have any money and you don't have any shit, so you can't come in my car. That's the hardest part of speaking here. It's not person. Serious. Anyway, I didn't let him in my car. And he actually got shot in the head that night, about an hour after I didn't let him in my car. And I got the opportunity to take somebody to treatment about 2 weeks ago who actually was his childhood friend. And we were in the car together. And he turned around to me and he said, how did that make you feel? And I wish I would say for the last 24 years I thought about that kid, but I didn't. But when that kid turned around and said, how did that make you feel? It made me feel like, you know, that's who I am. That's again who I am. Don't forget, just because you got this great life that sobriety gave you, just because you think you can like, just forget about who you were and stop doing this work and stop being, you know, the person that this program loved me into being. You know, and another thing happened on my relapse. I'd like to say that I came back to AA for the 12 steps or for the coffee. But I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous for the love because people loved me here. You know, so don't take that for granted that acceptance. People would call me up and they'd be like, do you want to hang out? And I'd be like, I'm not in your stupid club. I'm not going to hang out with you tonight. They're like, that's okay. You can still hang out. Those people pulled me from the gates of hell, keeping the door of AA open. And, you know, if anything I could do, I always want to keep it inclusive and keep the doors open for people who are out there. I finally surrendered on June 6, 1993. I surrendered to win, and I came, and I really became willing to do what you all told me to do. You know, I still worked in a bar, but I made it, guys. I worked in a bar, and I stayed sober. You know, I had 20 sponsors in my first 5 years. Like you all didn't. You know, I really came here really worthless and broken. I really had such a hole in my heart. And, you know, like one woman at a time, you know, because that's what I could do in the beginning. You know, I knew that I couldn't hang out with the guys. I knew that I had to get close to the women. As much as I didn't like you all, I knew you had what I needed. And it was like one hand at a time. You, like, patched me up, you know. And I got sponsors. And I just want to say that, you know, sometimes, like, I get, like, really crazy about that, you know, how many people contributed to me standing here. It's, like, mind-boggling, you know, that I can never forget that, you know, if I made 1,000 pots of coffee, if I drove 1,000 newcomers to me, and I'd never pay my debt, you know. And I also want to say the old timers used to always say to me, you know, if you have the first step, you have this program. If you have the first step. And I'd be like, that's crazy. I know I'm powerless. I know my life is unmanageable. So what? So what? That doesn't keep me here. Like, I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it. I got it. You know, like the big book is 44 pages to tell you one thing. If you got 110 pages to tell you 12 things. 110 pages. That's the directions for this program, 110. And you use 44 of them to tell you one thing. It must be pretty important. And I didn't get it for a long time. I don't have any power. Like, my power is not that I go to meetings, I do the work, and I'm doing this. It's my surrender that I have no power, and I have to pull a power greater than myself into me to be able to do this deal. It took me so long to wrap my head around the powerless scenario that I don't have the power to make good choices. I don't have any power. So I need to pull in a power. I can't choose to pick up. I can't choose to stay sober. Because if I think I'm choosing to stay sober, I'm in trouble. You know, the only choice I have is to surrender to a power greater than myself, turn my life and my will over that, and do the rest of this work. You know, but only with that power can I even do the rest of this work. So I also wanted to also talk about, like, some steps that have been swirling around that, you know, I'm just going to pick and choose. You know, the second step has been really big for me over the last few years, the second step proposition. You know, even in longer-term sobriety, I realized that I'll give you my drugs and alcohol, God. You got that. But I'm not giving you my money. I'm not going to give you my boyfriend. I'm not going to give you my other stuff. I'm just going to hang on to that stuff. Yeah, that didn't really work. It really left me really empty and fearful. You know, I love in the second step proposition, it says either God is everything or he's nothing. You know, and I had to come to that point that, you know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And that's, you know, that is a process ongoing to let go of those things that block me from being useful to God. Selfishness and self-centered. You know, it always comes down to that in all my inventories and all my days. It's like, where am I being selfish and self-centered? You know, people say I've been through the 12 steps, they didn't work. You know, I hear that a lot. They're like, I've been through the 12 steps, it didn't work. I'm like, oh, did you do the actual 12 step? Like, did you sponsor people? Did you help people? You know, through the entire book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right from the very, very, very beginning, like, they're not even hiding it. They put it in the foreword to the second edition. It says that self-sacrifice is vital to permanent recovery. So if they're saying that, they're not like saying like, hey, just a drive-by at a meeting. They're saying self-sacrifice is vital to permanent recovery right in the foreword. And then it goes on through the book and it says, you know, great things like, you know, if you're having problems with sex, you should help others all the most more. You know, I'm like, oh, all right. So if I'm having problems in that area, my solution is to help others. You know, it also says, which I read, I'm going to read to you what it says in the book. It actually says, on page 124, greater joy is to cling to the thought that God's hands, that the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. So what it's saying is that, like, all through the book, we're helping others. But the greatest possession we have is the wreckage that allows us to be of service to help others. My life might look really good to a lot of people, but there's been a lot of really hurtful stuff. You know, it's not rainbows and unicorns. You know, I lost my house in a foreclosure. I don't have any children. I am about a year out of a 10-year relationship where I thought I would be married today. You know, I've had money in the bank. I've had no money in the bank. I've watched my family die. You know, really stuff that's big stuff. And, you know, that answer of helping others, that's what works. You know, that's what works for me. You know, because I get out of me. Like, if all I think about is me, I'm so blocked off to that power that I just can't even feel anything. Without a doubt, hands down, the greatest joy of being a sober alcoholic is the ability to get out of my own head and to help somebody else. we have important places in the world. Like, I really feel like I am among, like, an amazing miracle. Like, every day while we sit in this meeting, someone will die from my disease. They will not be here tomorrow. And we're all sitting here. And we're getting this gift. And all we have to do to keep it is give it away. One of my favorite things in the book is about the father. It's in Family Afterwards. And it's about that the father, his pick strikes gold. And it's sobriety. Like, my pick struck gold. It's like, this is the mother lode here. And it says in the thing that when you first get it, you just want to keep it all to yourself. You're like, yo, I'm all fixed up. I can get a job. I can get a man. These people fixed me up. I'm ready to go. And, you know, that's your first maybe reaction. But then you realize that it's a limitless load and that all I have to do is mine it for the rest of my life and then give away all of it in order to keep it. And it's just amazing that that's the life that we have. I can't say how grateful I am for the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, for the God that I have that's always with me. It's just, it's really overwhelming that a girl who's just like really, just would just really, really be just nowhere. Like I was working on a casket in a jail cell when I came here. I would watch my mom die. Like that's who I was. And to have the turnaround that I can actually be a person who thinks about others and a person that is walking in this path, I'm just unbelievably grateful. And I'm going to end it that. Thank you.